We're here, studios in South Yarra. You've just recorded your audiobook.
Yes, I have. I just finished. Yeah, that's great. Although I think I might do some pickups. Ben's out there. He's going, yes, might do some pickups.
Yeah.
So, you know, do an extra 200 pages again.
Yeah, fab.
Yeah.
Well, I was interested in the addendum. Lots of stuff you didn't talk about.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, there was. That's right. I did list them all, didn't I? They're sort of prospective chapter headings
for
another book. But they do seem to come in threes or even fours.
Mm.
Stephen Fry, not that I'm in his league, but he seems to have done more than me. But I think he's done three.
Oh, he's done a couple. I don't know. I Clive James is my benchmark. He did loads.
He did. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a lot of anthology of his criticism as well.
Yeah.
I don't think I would put everything that I've ever done on paper. I think that would be very. I had to be very selective in my book. I mean, having just read it and been fresh out of it, there are some things I remember kind of thinking, oh, I could skip over this story. This is a bit dull. So I was even going to edit it.
Yeah.
And I left the appendices out.
Mm.
I don't think they should be in the audiobook. I don't know what the rules are. It's a developing form, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, just do what you want. It's your thing.
I did. Look, I listened to a few before I did this one, and the most recent one was John Cleese's.
Mm.
And John, have you heard his? So Anyway?
No.
Okay, so I read it and a few years back when it came out, and then in preparation of this I thought I'd listen to a few, as I did when I wrote. I read a few autobiographies before I wrote mine, thinking what's the best one. And I thought Alan Alda's Never Stuff Your Dog, I think it's called, that's a really good one. But Cleese's audio book has him doing the preliminaries and being a bit bored with it, you know, doing the, yes, this book is written, but I don't want to do this. And so the sound engineer says, oh, Michael Palin's downstairs doing another book. I says, oh, we'll go and get him to do it. So you hear the sound engineer apparently walk down the stairs, knock on the booth door, Palin's in there, Palin comes upstairs, reads the opening of John's book, and then John says, would you mind hanging around doing the credits at the end? Oh, well, sure, John, yes, that's all right. Is there a fee involved? Very funny. So none of that's in the book. So I guess there are no rules, really.
You didn't have Francis around.
No, I haven't been as brave as Cleese, no.
I mean, it would have been lucky if he were downstairs.
It would have been. Well, he does a lot of it. In fact, he's been in here quite a bit. He does a lot more. In fact, he would have been, for one fleeting moment, I was considering just having him do my entire book.
Yeah.
So I thought that would be interesting.
Yeah.
Because he does, he's a professional actor.
Yeah, or Stephen Hall. He would have done it.
Stephen would have done it. Yeah, Stephen's just done his own book. Which is like multi-voice and character. So he's done his own. He's probably a bit tired now.
Yeah. Have you listened to Lolly Scramble?
No, I've read it.
Yeah.
I haven't listened to it. It's all on Bandcamp or something.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, I must do that.
I did get it on Audible a while ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's my comfort audiobook.
Well, Tony Martin, beautiful writer, and I imagine it would work very well, almost like stand-up, I suppose.
Oh, it's just incredible. And he has this, speaking of Alan Alda, he has this anecdote of sort of spending time with his crush as a teenager, and they watch an episode of MASH together, but unfortunately it's one of the most more depressing episodes of MASH, and it just, you know, it just goes down like a lead balloon, really.
I didn't find out until recently, because I was doing a podcast with somebody in the UK, that when they showed MASH in the UK, there was no laugh track.
Right, yeah.
So in Australia, we got the American one with the laugh track on it, although I think the last couple of seasons didn't have one. I can't remember now. A few of the episodes didn't. Like Get Smart for some reason.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Don Adams never watched Get Smart because he hated the laugh track.
So. Oh, okay.
Which seems like a real shame because it was...
It's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's a funny show.
Yeah, I think he's denied himself some pleasure. Yeah, but he got his way, I think, by the end.
Yeah.
And I think in the last couple of seasons they didn't have one.
Yeah. And also they did the films and they didn't have the laugh track.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I've got an...
All right, yes.
Problem. Yeah, I wanted to talk to you since... My blog is entirely about music. We don't talk about anything else.
Okay, no, let's
according
not.
To my news. No, but I wanted to talk about your Princess Di moment. In my head, I imagined you like John Travolta dancing with Princess Di to Haircut 100. Can you tell me about that?
Well, yes, I'm at university. I'm a member of the students' union, so I was involved vaguely on the periphery of university politics. And so Di and Charles are visiting Australia. And the student union invites them to a dance that I think they pretended was something we do every year, but I think they just did it for them because they were there that week. Anyway, some stupidly the equerry in charge of their arrangements said yes, and they turned up, and I was there, and so it's all DJ music, and yes, Love Plus One by Haircut, 100 or 1,000?
100.
Yeah. Starts, and they take to the floor, and of course there's a big cheer, and then everybody joins them. So I'm there. I've got a date for the night, and we're dancing around. I've kind of, you know, just happened to be near them. I didn't actually make a beeline to be near them or anything. And of course, they're taking pictures and things. And we turned at the same time, and so I was actually we were both looking at each other, and we did look at each other as we're dancing. And so in my mind's eye, if you took a picture of it and crop out everybody else around us, it would look like she and I were dancing. We were close enough for it to be conceivably dancing together. Mm. So that's the screen grab I have as a retinal burn in my mind. And then for a moment there, I thought, well, maybe we would fall in love in this moment. You only need a moment really to fall in love, but no, it didn't happen. And she turned and continued dancing with Charles. And well, you know. Hey, life might have turned out very different for her if she had taken up with me in that moment. But no, Dodie Fayed, apparently.
I know, I was going to say. More than I. You could have been the Dodie.
Yeah, but that's as close as I've come to royalty. Had I been on the other side, I would have been dancing with Charles.
Yeah, I was going to say, Charles didn't punch you in the mouth.
I don't think he cared that much. It was pretty early in the relationship, yeah.
Very exciting.
Yeah,
Were you given any sort of briefing in terms of like how you should approach them, talk to them?
No, we weren't supposed to talk to them unless we were asked, like unless we were summoned by the equerry to come over.
Mm.
I remember going to it was a launch for the Comedy Channel on Foxtel, and Lachlan Murdoch was running this big party. For some reason I was there, I can't remember why. It was possibly, why was I there? I can't remember. Anyway, I was there.
You're a famous comedian.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, maybe. I was I was in the trawl and dumped there as one of the guests. But Glenn Robbins was, more famous than I am, and Sarah Ferguson, who was there. That would have meant that Prince Andrew was there.
Mm.
Anyway, well, maybe she was divorced at that point. Anyway, she called over Glenn Robbins. She got the equerry to come and get what's her title? I can't remember now. Duchess of York.
I was going to say Fergie, but yeah.
No, I don't
think title.
Equerry wouldn't be that informal. So the Duchess of York would like to spend some time with you. Glenn got up and went and talked to her, which I felt a bit demeaning. I think I would have refused just out of some bullshit.
What, just being summoned by a princess?
Yeah, who does she think she is?
I know. Call Russell Coit over.
Yeah, Russell Coit, and not me. I didn't even have the chance to refuse her. Anyway, no dancing for those two.
Yeah, nobby doldrums to the...
Yes. No, I think I came off better. I think my moment with Di, that's more impressive.
Yeah, and certainly more romantic, I think, than being summoned.
Absolutely.
Do you know the story about George Harrison meeting, I think it was Princess Margaret, and he was very famished at the time.
Yeah.
And he, basically told her to push off because they couldn't eat while she was around. I mean, I'm obviously paraphrasing, but this is like, but you know how hungry George was.
Yeah. In fact, you might remember at the very end of my book, I talk about a story. I give the sort of the lead for a story that isn't included in the book where I actually met his coat. I met his coat, yeah. It was because he used to go to the Adelaide Grand Prix quite a bit. And I was at a party. This might have been towards the very end of the life of the Grand Prix in Adelaide. And so we go in there, and there's all these people in this sort of hotel, bigger hotel room, and there's this green coat. I'm just there, and someone says, "Oh, that's George Harrison's coat." I said, "Is George Harrison here?" "Yeah, George Harrison's here. That's his coat." And I thought, "Oh, great!" So I just sat near the coat, waiting for him to leave, basically to grab it. But no, apparently he left without his. He had a hat and a coat. They couldn't find the hat. And so the publicist came back to get the coat. Oh. So she said she confirmed it was his coat.
Right.
So that's as close as I've got to the Beatles. See, meeting his coat. It was a very friendly coat and pretty much as I expected.
You could have slipped a note.
The quiet one.
Yeah,
that
coat. I mean.
Just green.
Oh, geez.
Hmm.
Well, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, that was pretty good. Lady Di for a second, nanosecond, and an hour and a half, I think, near his coat.
Yeah, right. That's pretty a long good. Time. And I imagine you wouldn't have been able to conduct any conversation with anyone around it because you'd just been staring at the coat.
No. Someone said he was there with Ronnie Wood.
Oh, right.
And Ron, I thought, well, even if Ronnie comes and to get a coat for him, that would be interesting. That's a good story. Yeah. But no, I have no anecdote at all. Just the coat and the publicist.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you know his, like, William Morris jacket.
No.
Sort of notoriously ugly.
Right.
Yeah, it was sort of, he wore it sort of 1967-ish. Anyway, they have it, had it displayed in a museum in London.
Okay.
They're like, oh, this is George Harrison's coat. But they had it sort of, the image of him emblazoned on the back.
Okay.
But you can just see from the print of it, it's clearly not the coat that he's wearing.
Okay.
So you're like, okay, well, that's a nicer demonstration coat. And a similar thing
that's
with,
odd.
With
and that would be a very small coat. I would have thought their clothing would have been quite small.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it tends to.
Is it in the doco? Is it in? Do they include it in the Get Back doco?
No, they don't. It's a bit early for that. Did you watch Get Back?
Great. Yeah, look. Yeah, I thought it was great. Yeah. I mean, it was so lovely and crisp and vivid, and it could have been shot last week. And of course, they're all about 24, 25. Yeah, no, I thought it was great. Even though it's a long sit, people have commented about the length of it. I actually think it benefits from it turns it into the everyday and kind of makes it a bit more special. So I know, I thought it was fascinating. The only thing I thought was a bit weird was the Peter Sellers comes to visit and obviously nothing was said. It must have been very awkward, and that's kind of a bit choppy editing wise. I might have left that out. They're kind of sitting there looking a bit embarrassed and obviously been told to talk, but the Beatles are sitting in a row and Sellers are standing behind, and of course within a month would be off shooting The Magic Christian with Ringo. Yes. I remember, sidebar issue, I talked to John Cleese, I was interviewing John Cleese about Spamalot or something, and I mentioned that film to him, The Magic Christian, because Cleese and Chapman had written a draft of it. I think Terry Southern's draft is the preeminent one. And Cleese is in it, and Cleese plays the auction house representative for Sotheby's, and he has a scene with Sellers. And Cleese said, yes, I watched that the other day, which is a complete lie, he wouldn't watch it the other day. I thought it was way too slow. I thought that was very interesting. I thought it was a very funny scene. Apparently he's the first person to say shit in a British film, because that's 1968, I think.
Right.
Because they cuts out the nose of the School of Rembrandt picture and Cleese says, shit!
And that's the first one in The Magic Christian?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. Amazing. There we go.
It must have been some neat interplay because you're a fan of that film.
Oh, yeah.
And also seeing sort of the pressure that it created in this documentary. It would have been quite interesting.
Yeah. I mean, Sellers and Harrison apparently were quite close. In fact, I feel like I'm dropping names here, but
this is the point.
I talked to Eric Idle not long ago because he did he was here in Australia doing a one-off show at the State Theatre in Sydney, and he was telling me about, like, he met Sellers a few times because he's a good friend of Harrison's, and I think in the Beatles anthology series, there's footage of Harrison watching home movie footage of Sellers doing an impression of Harrison. That's pop culture eating itself twice.
Yeah, it's very awkward when Peter Sellers comes around. It's like he rolls up and he's like, well, you're obviously a very boring bunch of people. I mean, that's the kind of energy that he brings to it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. He didn't ever really seem quite at ease with himself. But
No. There's an Australian actor called Bruce Venables who used to be a cop in Hong Kong before he became an actor. And he tells a great story about he was still on duty. Sellers is over there in Hong Kong shooting the Hong Kong bits of Revenge of the Pink Panther. And they, they seconded basically a whole unit of the police department over there to look after the film unit. So it's set, and Sellers shouted them drinks and food at some hotel. And spent the whole night telling goon show stories, doing voices. For him, I think, according to Venables, for him it was like the old army days. So he's there with people he's really, really comfortable with because it feels like the old army, the old gang show. Yeah, well, I'd love to have met him. I think of all the comedians that I admire, he's the one. He's the kind of the Moby Dick. He's the one I really would have liked to have met, even though I've read so much about him, and it would have been a bit. Chances are he would have been pretty prickly or dismissive.
Yeah, yeah. This is because it seems this anxiety about rapport. I mean, maybe, this is, about meeting Jerry Lewis and,
I
mean, surely getting your Moby Dick would have been very stressful for you. If he was, he was quite cold or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, given he died in, when did he die? 1980? 82, something like that. He died at 54. I would have been very young, so I probably would have been completely blitzed by it.
Mm-hmm.
As I've gotten older, I can be a little more cavalier about it. You know, it doesn't really matter what people think of me. It's just more like, well, let's see if this is an interesting experience. So that's why it was great to meet Eric Idle and to interview him on stage, and we got on quite well. And, he was kind of like you'd hope he'd be.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's always nice.
And also you had the precedent of having met John Cleese before, so you could always say, well, according to your buddy.
That's right. Well, I've done, apart from Chapman, and Gilliam, I just missed out. I haven't met Gilliam, but I've met all the others and had chatted to all the others. Yeah, so that's pretty cool.
Do they ever ask who your favourite is? And then
no, I haven't. They haven't put me on the spot.
Oh, lucky. Okay, should we?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Should
look,
we
you
talk
know,
about?
You have very kindly asked me to bring my my old iPod in, and I was attempting to find it to charge it up last night, and I cannot find it. But I have everything on my iPhone 4.
Oh, nice.
Apart from a couple of LimeWire illegal downloads, which would have been, I can tell you what that one was, actually. It was a bootleg version of the Danny Elfman opening to Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Oh, yeah.
For some reason I...
Did it give you a virus?
It was... no, it was fine. All of your listeners, if LimeWire is still around, use it. It's just that app, when you put it on Apple and iTunes and stuff, they weed them out. They get rid of them all. So they're not on this phone. But I have. I can take you through what I've got here,
yeah,
if you like.
Yeah,
okay.
Fabulous.
So we have Poison Arrow and The Look of Love by the ABC. And then weirdly, Arcade Fire... from the album Reflector, Normal Person. What's that, about 30 years between them?
I like the title track from, I like Reflector from that album. Do you know the title track?
No, no.
No, it's pretty good.
I only heard Normal Person because I think it was on the Colbert Report. I thought, oh, that's good, I like that. B-52s, some B-52s in there. And then it's like three pages of the Beatles. I've printed this out, listeners. I rather than get Eleanor to actually try and read my iPhone 4.
Ah, you know my name.
Yes, great. All great. All from Anthology, actually.
Yeah.
So they're all alternate takes. And
yeah.
Most of the Beatles stuff that I'm very familiar with is not from the official albums. It's all take three, or it's live, or it falls apart at the end.
Yeah.
So I
love it. Like and your bird can sing, and they're just laughing all the way through.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just really cute. Or Paul's broken the glass.
Yeah.
Broken the glass
at last. Paul's broken the glass. Oh, you daft git. There we go. Then we're back into some album stuff. So again, look, I've got Eleanor 3-4 pages of Beatles here, and then something from Turn Me On, Dead Man, which I think might be a. You probably got it actually. It's a bootleg album with that picture that Brian Epstein said under no circumstances is anybody to see it, where they're all holding a bunch of decapitated dolls' heads. There's a whole lot of alternate takes there. Including just the backing music for Help, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. Again, I'm sure you've got it somewhere.
Would you call that the karaoke version?
Yeah, it would be. And it's the, it's the boys playing there. You can't get more. There we are. That one there, Help. We won't play it because you'll have to pay royalties or something.
No, I know this is an entirely illegal operation. I'll include all these songs.
Okay. I'll dig it up if you like. So Beatles. And then we get into Bernard Herrmann. So the soundtrack for North by Northwest, for some reason, is on my iPod. Look at that. Every single track is there. A bit of Blondie, a Bonzo Dog, and then Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks for a couple of pages. Those wonderful, improvised, spontaneous, 2,000-year-old man sketches. Daft Punk. And then a whole lot of Danny Elfman.
Yes, I've been obsessed with Oingo Boingo recently. He's just incredible. He's so talented.
Yeah, amazing. And I think Oingo Boingo have reformed. I think they're appearing every now and again. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. A lot of that's there because Stephen Curry and I revived their stage show Good Evening, which we did in the same theatres that they did when they did it here in Australia. Elvis Costello. Elvis Presley, but not the original ones, the kind of remix, the Viva remix of Bossa Nova Baby and Little Less Conversation, which I think people know from Ocean's 11. The 2000, no, what's that? Also Sprach Zarathustra, but it's the Emile, can you read that?
Emile Deodato?
Yeah, that's the version that's in Being There. When Peter Sellers goes out from his Washington garret for the first time and walks through. So it's quite an interesting sort of disco version of it. And then there's Ezekiel's version of the Montague and Capulet, Prokofiev's music from the ballet Romeo and Juliet. I don't know. Now, this is one of those ones that sometimes happens with Spotify. If I leave it running, it'll suggest things. Mm-hmm. And I think it must have suggested that. And it's great. I really like it. Thank you, artificial intelligence. You know me. The Church, there you go, Under the Milky Way Tonight and The Unguarded Moment. Peter Quinn. Oh, The Cure. Yes, The Cure for a few there. Split Ends. Susanna Vega, who I saw in Adelaide when she toured. I think she came here once. And she had laryngitis, so she sounded like Bonnie Tyler. It's good though; she's very good. Touch and Go, do you know? Touch and Go.
This is a real 2001 kind of a track.
That's right. Yeah. McCartney and Wings, Live and Let Die. Mm. That's great stuff. But oddly enough, the reason I think I probably downloaded there was because I'd seen an Albert Brooks film. Albert Brooks and Michael Douglas in a film, what was that called? The In-Laws. And they were they were the fathers of the two children who'd gotten married. And they used it as the opening, which I think was very brave to use a Bond, very, very well-established popular Bond opening title for another film. There we go, Dizzy. Now, it says Master Version 1, and that's because it's a version I did for talking about a generation. So that the song that...
Well, like Vic Reeves.
Yeah, like the Vic Reeves one. So it's pretty much that arrangement. And it only goes for about 30 seconds, but for some reason it was on my iPod. Henry Mancini, there we go, some Inspector Clouseau and Pink Panther music. Iggy Pop's Wild America, which I think he sings with... Kate Pearson, from B-52s.
And was it Candy?
Yes, yeah. Candy. Maybe that's the one. Maybe Wild America's not with Kate Pearson. Maybe Candy. Yes, Candy is. I haven't got that one there. John Lennon from Sometime in New York. I don't know. I'm embarrassed to say My Sharona is on there, but it is.
Isn't this a bit modern? Uptown Funk.
Yeah.
Where did you put that on?
Well, that wouldn't have been on the iPod because I think what happens is if I plugged it in, it just updated it. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of things. Weirdly, there was, what's his name, who took over the lead singing on Queen?
Adam Lambert.
Adam Lambert. I don't know why that's there. It must have been one of my sons that's turned up there. A bit of Michael Jackson, The Offspring. Some of these look like they were studies for Mad as Hell because we'd sometimes use a closing number for the final series of whatever season we were doing was some sort of old thing that was lying around.
And did you always choose the songs in terms of...
Yeah. Usually the beginning of the season. So we'd have it all schmick by the time we got there. And that came about because when I was doing McCall of Tonight, which was a short-lived... chat show. I don't know why we did it, but anyway, short-lived chat show on Channel 9. They gave me a car, which was very nice of them to get to and from work. And it was such an old car that it had a cassette player in it. So the only thing I could play on it, obviously, was cassettes. So I dug out my old ones and would put them in. So Look of Love, for example, or Poison Arrow, whichever one it was, the only reason we did that in the show is because I kept listening to it on the way to work every day. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I reckon I could hit that in terms of my pitch. So, yes, I haven't thrown away any cassettes. I could have brought them in. So a lot of split ends. George Harrison.
I was going to ask you, where did you get the idea to mash Christopher Walken and David Bowie?
Yeah, well, that would have been the same thing. I would have been listening to Bowie, and I think I'd just worked out how to do Walken, and that was reason enough.
Yeah.
But it kind of works. There's a brand new dance, but I don't know. It's the I don't know, it's name. That seems to work quite nicely. I don't know what people made of it. I thought it was axed, that show. A bit more Henry Mancini, and that seems to be that's as much as I've got.
Wow. You'll have to sign it.
There we go. I think predominantly we have the Beatles. Beatles very, very well represented on the iPod.
Very good. And mostly anthology. So you were into the anthology when it happened?
Yeah. I think that, I had the LPs, some of the LPs, not all of them. That opened it up. I mean, I think I'm interested in, like, whenever I read biography, a good biography is one that paints the context of the person's life. And so it's more or less a historical document. So I think that series helped put them into context for me. So I guess I enjoyed the play between the team member, the band members on those tracks, the ones that were either fell apart or they were pushing their way and discovering how to write something, because we're so familiar with the songs. It's like that moment in Get Back when Paul is pushing out, he's pushing out Get Back. And Ringo's sort of urging him on. I could see just how important he was to that band, really in terms of being glue when it was needed. George is kind of bored, but he's there listening to it, but not really giving him the benefit of the energy of the will. So, but I don't think McCartney needed anyone there. Remember there's a section in Get Back where he's just noodling around at the piano with some sound and some young camera op or something like that. Yeah. He's just,
And he's like, this is how it's done.
This is how it's done.
And it seems like almost anyone who was willing to sit down with him and listen to him for a bit, he was going to.
He would work with him. Yeah. I think, he just seems like an instinctively collaborative person. I haven't met him, but I think he'd be quite a nice fella. He's just forcing it out. And of course we know it, and we go and we want him to succeed. We want him to actually write the song in some weird time machine way. We're going to shout the note out to him. So, that's my iPod.
That's very nice. Thank you for sharing.
That's all right.
I think one nice thing, talking about Paul for a second, is that he's very comfortable with creative permutations. Mm-hmm. Like, he's very good with just mixing stuff around, and seeing if it works. If it doesn't work, it's not a big deal, and he doesn't get too attached to anything.
Yeah. He doesn't get it. There's no sense that I can pick up that he thinks there's a limited well of inspiration available to him, like all that weird fireman stuff. You hear that in the songs too, because they roll out a length of fabric and go, well, that's 2.5 minutes, and it's got 7 ideas in there, and people would probably use each one for a song these days. Mm. But that's the comically, Peter Cook was a bit similar to that. It'd just roll out with no sense of a gear calibrating how much was coming out. They're the geniuses, really. Mm. Even when he had nothing to say, there was still some genius in the music at the very least.
So you've always shoehorned your musical taste into your comedy. Was this always sort of a bit of a risk? In case the audience didn't get it, did it matter to you that people got it?
You want them to have some fun when they're watching it. Usually I try not to do just one thing. I think it's too risky. So there's a few things going on there. And often the delivery system, if you can make that funny and quirky for the joke, or the idea or the climate that you're trying to create where people can enjoy themselves, Yeah, if they don't get that, they'll get something else that's nearby, or they'll just like the song, or they'll just, you know, like the fact that it's bad taste because you're doing the song.
Mm.
But no, it's more an art than a science, I think. And it doesn't always work, I'm happy to admit that. But
it always seems like there's this sort of the moment-by-moment approval, mm-hmm. and sort of like trying to figure out whether like a joke lands, whether they get it.
Well, you can kind of feel it because they're not one entity, you know, they're lots of different. So it's like a sea, you know, it's like you're kind of dancing with, you know, let's just take us back to the State Theatre with Eric Idle. He's got 2,000 people in front of him and he's playing them, he's mustering them, he's dancing with them, you know, and so there's a little laugh from the right and there's a big laugh from the top and it's, you know, it's washing over him, you know, it's washing over him and then rolling back to the back of the theatre. It's and, you know, a good comedian, and he's obviously a very good comedian, can hold those moments and do stuff within, like Ringo doing fill on a song. You know, he could do a whole lot of things as the penny drops for various people. It's quite amazing to be in the moment, in that sort of moment.
I think.
And you know, and you just feel it. You know, there's no, you may have a, I think I have an understanding of the technical side of it all. Like I can tell when something goes wrong, but I can only feel when it goes right. I don't really know why it works, if it does work. I'm sure I can pull it apart and analyse it when it doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess appreciating the ebb and flow of it and the sort of the spatial element to it.
Yeah, yeah. And if you don't get them at the moment you think you were going to get them, if you're any good, you can catch them because of that. You can do another joke on the back of it that rescues you. You know, if it doesn't land, then you've got to have something in reserve to save you and move on to the next bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, that's the tension of not knowing whether it's, of doing the joke, not knowing whether it's going to work. That is the attractive thing about it, that moment of, it's like pulling the handle on a pokey machine and just you don't know quite whether it's going to pay out or not. A fair idea.
Yeah.
Very good, but there's no guarantees.
Yeah. No, of course. The parts of Matters that I will always love are the corpsing. Sort of like yes. The interaction with the characters where they seem to laugh and you seem to, and it seems to fall apart, but not too drastically. It's a very subtle sort of like collapse, but then just a breath later and it's just back to normal.
Yeah, know? I think I was a bit more confident about leaving that sort of stuff in towards the back end of the series because I used to think it was a bit indulgent. But I think the audience enjoys, they enjoy the actors playing together as long as you don't destroy the character completely, but you can peek out from behind the character a little bit and give the audience a wink or each other a wink and that's absolutely worth something. And I looked towards the end, I just was sitting there laughing at, you know, whoever was there, Stephen Hall or Christy, whoever it was. And it didn't matter so much, you know, it didn't really matter because people would, I think, were taking me like as a serious newsreader and they didn't really, that conceit seemed to have disappeared by about year five. And I was just basically doing stand-up comedy from a seated position.
But it can be so subtle where Roz was talking about ScoMo having such a beautiful soul and yes. Just a side eye to camera. I'm like, it was such a delicious moment.
Well, you know, the whole show really is sarcasm but without the intonation in our voice. Mm. We found pretty early on that if we acted a little bit, if we sounded sarcastic, it would ruin it completely. So we said everyone's really sincere and even the interview subjects, they might be stupid, but they know they're single-minded. They're not actually too stupid. They're just single-minded. They only know one thing.
Yeah.
And it's just to get this point across. And that's how, on my reading, that's how often those political interviews appeared, is that people were so focused and being on message that they didn't let any light in.
Yeah. And you're just hammering at them with logic and
yeah.
the circular.
On some of them. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So did you have a particular favourite musical finale for Mad As? And whose idea was it to bring the synth on stage?
Yeah, that was a carryover from Talking About Your Generation.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, there was a lot of carryovers from Talking About Your Generation. No, I thought just I have no musical ability at all, but I quite it just seemed like a naff thing to do on Generation, and we use the same production company, the same art department. He still had it, so you know we'd bring it out every now and again.
And the phone as well, of course.
The phone, yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah, we didn't have a meerkat popping out of the desk. That was too much.
Although
we
were no skull.
No skull. That's right. Yes. Yeah. It was a complicated show, Generation, wasn't it?
Yeah. I was in the audience a couple of times for the sort of the earlier incarnation. My heart would break for Gen Z because they were so fucking stupid. I just didn't know anything about.
No. Well, they weren't exactly terribly well represented by Josh Thomas.
I mean, I was going to say.
I don't know. Okay. He doesn't know. Well, thank God Charlie was there. Is there anyone who could answer any questions? Amanda was okay, but she was too slow. You know, she was like my age. So, you know, trying to get the answers out wasn't. You know, conducive to a TV show that was supposed to be 43 minutes long.
No, but she surprised me because, you know, in my head, Amanda Keller is beyond 2000. So she's, you know, all tech and hoverboards and what's going to happen in the future. So she often surprised me with like, hey, you're meant to be on top. Come on.
Nah, didn't know anything. Thank you, Charlie. He took it very seriously, like it was a real thing.
Yeah. So, and you had the Veronicas as well, I saw.
Yeah. They were on. Yeah, no, they were great fun. Yeah. No, that was the fun. The fun of that show was bamboozling, you know, people who were usually pretty cool, you know, who were brave enough to come on and not do their usual shtick.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you seem to have fun with it. More fun in the second incarnation or?
I had as much fun in a different sort of way because they were different personnel, you know, because I knew, I think the first version of it on Channel 10, we were literally getting to know each other, and that was kind of fun to watch for the audience and fun for us. In the Channel 9 version, I knew Robin very well and I knew Andy well enough. Lawrence I didn't know, but we kind of sorted ourselves out pretty quickly on that. So that was just more sure-footed probably and a bit more certain and probably had too much of me being insane. So I remember we did one episode where I sent everybody off gradually in the first segment so because they were answering questions badly. And in the end, I don't even think we asked questions. It was just before, as we were during the setup. So they're all gone. We didn't even do round one. We went to a commercial. And the executive producer from ITV came in and said, well, when do we have to do that again? We haven't done anything. That was funny. That was all right. That was we killed 8 minutes. That's fine. Start the show.
No one left on the show.
No one left. I think we had one guy from the audience. He was the only guy that was allowed to be on set, and I sent him off as well.
So no one's qualified?
No.
No. But we've joked about your Delta Goodrum interview on McAuliffe Tonight. Do you have a particular favourite musical interview that you've done?
Well, it was probably one that didn't go to air, actually, which I think is now on YouTube with the lead singer of the Dandy Warhols.
Mm-hmm.
Because the very last show we did of McAuliffe Tonight featured me teasing that we would be having the Dandy Warhols next week, and they were already there lined up. The thing is we actually shot it in that week, obviously. So they're standing there ready to go and I'm saying, we'll see you next week. Do you mind hanging around? Oh, okay. And so we shot, the show finished, we shot their performance and I also interviewed, what's his name? Who's the lead singer of the Dandy Warhols?
Oh, this is, I know, he's got a woman's name.
Ben, who's the lead singer of the Dandy Warhols? Courtney Taylor-Taylor, thank you, Ben.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So he and I had great fun. It was a really fun interview, and I think maybe because it didn't go to air, there's a perverse pleasure in me thinking that's the best interview. But I did enjoy that. And I remember showing him an X-ray of my knee and showing where I'd torn the cartilage, and I thought, well, there's an interesting moment.
But didn't you do that with Brian Molko as well from Placebo?
Did I? Oh, probably. I was doing it every week. It's kind of running gag. No, sure. And again, it's no surprise that show was axed.
What are you talking about?
doesn't deserve to live. I remember thinking that when I hearing the audience laugh, it's a Channel 9 audience, so it's just slightly later than it should happen in the studio, just slightly, a little bit of a drag. But I took pleasure from that because I remember watching a Channel 9 version of Peter Cook and Dudley Moore doing their show in Australia, so they did an hour special.
Yeah.
And they were doing, you know, One Leg Too Few and all their popular sketches, and the laughs are slightly later than they should be. Like the audience is laughing out of obligation rather than genuine delight. I'm sure they were just bamboozled by it.
My favourite Pete Smith prize read is where you win open heart surgery from the students at Box and Safe.
Right.
I remember just literally dying when I heard that. I think I didn't recover for about 10 minutes. But, and there was something I think you threw to Mick Molloy. So, on the streets. Like, oh,
yeah.
Good luck. I don't know. Fuck Channel 9, it was a great show.
Exactly. Won an ARIA, DVD.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go.
You know what I was going to bring, since we're on the topic of things we should have brought but we didn't, I have your My Generation CD.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I have that somewhere in my house because the thing is I did my articles at Shock.
Oh,
and
okay.
Where I did,
there you go.
I was paid 33 cents an hour and I was given a McAuliffe program DVD box set and your CD.
Very nice. Well, there you go. Well, that's a rare acquisition. I don't think there's too many.
I'm sure it grows for a fortune on Discogs. So.
Yes, yes. I'm not sure. Yes, I remember telling Josh Thomas that I'd done a comedy DVD, a comedy CD, and he said, "Why?" You know, it was 2000 and whatever it was, 2008, 2009. Just couldn't believe that someone would still be doing it. It was the equivalent of, you know, issuing a piano roll or a. Yeah.
Incidentally, a piano roll would have been very convenient for you.
Yes, yes, that's right. I could have used it.
A piano. Let me see. Okay, so I've got a fast money round.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Best band.
Best band. The Cure is popping into my head.
Nice. First single.
First single was. Let me think. First single. I didn't buy singles that much. Oh yeah, no. George Benson's Breezin'.
Oh, nice.
There you go. Yeah, I actually went out and bought that. $1.20.
$1.20. First gig.
First what?
First gig.
First gig. Oh, okay. Look, it was Cold Chisel at the, Cold Chisel at the some basketball arena.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay. And most underrated band or musician?
Well, we spoke of her. Suzanne Vega, I think, is very underrated.
Yeah, I love her.
Yeah. She didn't really help everybody. I mean, she didn't do a lot. Didn't bring out a lot, but I always thought she deserved more applause and awards than she received.
And most starstruck to me, in terms of musicians, not.
Oh, okay. Musicians. Well, I was really impressed with Darryl Braithwaite, mainly because he'd just done Macbeth.
Yeah.
Yes, I was very impressed. I got to interview him for SAFM, which was a radio station in Adelaide.
Yeah, there's a great photo of you two in this in your book.
Yeah, but he doesn't look like himself.
You don't look like yourself.
No. Well, there we go. Well, that's fair then. He can't say. He has to explain the photo when he shows it to people, and so do I.
Is this pre-Rise or pre, like, what year would have this have been?
It would have been 82, 80. Hang on, well, it would have, I can't remember. Yeah, it was whenever that came out because he was flogging the album. 85, maybe?
Yeah. Citation needed.
Yeah.
Did we cover this most uncomfortable musical interview?
Oh, who's the other guy in Cold Chisel? Don Walker. There we go. Thank you.
What was so awkward about?
Because I didn't know anything. It was on SAFM. On Vega, and he came in. He was flogging some personal appearance, and I was trying to talk about his music intelligently, and I think I said it was like. I said, "Oh, this is more rhythm and blues, which is not really what you do." And he says, "Oh, yeah, that's true. No, I always do rhythm and blues." He was happy to play along for about half a second, and then he said, "No, you know, basically, I'm an idiot and I don't know any of his work at all. That's all R&B, apparently."
All right.
Yeah,
what happened with
awkward.
You and Alice Cooper?
I impersonated Alice Cooper to do a prank call on our program director.
Yeah.
At Vega, because he told me, our program director said, "Oh, no, prank calls are always very funny. You should do prank calls." All right, well, I'll show you how damn unfunny they are. So I rang up him and complained to him that somebody had impersonated, like, I'm Alice.
Yeah.
Saying, and it wasn't even Alice's voice, it's a vague American accent. Going, yeah, you got some guy on your breakfast program doing an impression of me. And so, oh, I'm so sorry about that. What would he say? Well, he rang up the program executive and he pretended he was me. And then finally he realizes what's going on and he forbids me to play it on air and explains the theater of the mind to me. Yes. Right. So that was it was more Woody Allen than. Alice Cooper, idiot.
favorite band currently? Last one.
Favorite band currently? Yes, let me think now. God. I don't listen to anything after 1998. No, I have to pass on that one.
I mean, it doesn't have to be a current band. Which band do you...
Oh, do I still listen to? Okay, well, Bangtail by Harry James is top of the... My particular pop
is that
list at the
Cat Empire? Or am I thinking of somebody else?
No, Harry James, like 1948.
Okay, right. Okay,
no, real old school. Bangtail is the song.
The R&B.
It's the song that Miss Cartledge dances to with Jerry Lewis in The Ladies' Man.
Oh, nice.
So it's 1962, so this would be with the Harry James Orchestra actually in the film. Yeah, but it's great. It's a great track.
Neat. I'll have to seek that out.
A lot of brass, a lot of swing.
Yeah. And I guess you listen to it because you're thinking of the corresponding film, right?
Yeah, well, that's my gateway to a lot of music is film.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In fact, that's probably that is the keystone under which I walk when I go through the gate to almost anything, you know. So my knowledge of, like, comedy, like, you know, like Python is the great touchstone for learning about philosophers for me, you know. You know, you just listen to Eric Idle's philosopher song and then you go and look up the real ones. It's a great, great handbook for the sued.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. A great leveler. And I'm guessing you're just shazamming everything or you're...
No, I think I might have done that for Montagues and Capulets. But I'm old school.
Oh, yeah.
You take me years.
You stay for the credits.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Clapping along at the end. Well, thank you for your time, Sean.
Eleanor, it's a pleasure to meet you and talk to you. Absolutely. And, yes, you can keep the printouts if you like.
Oh, amazing.
There you go.
Fabulous.
All right.